Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I told you it was going to be a great show. This hour we have Father Tad Boholczyk with us, and we're going to talk about bioethics. And if the world seems to be in many ways in great difficulty and moral peril, probably in no other place is that more the case than in bioethics. In those things we can do to our own biology and to the biology of others also, and this it makes sense that these two things go together, a time of great opportunity, a time of great possibility in the very same area. So I suppose it's common to the human experience that as we gain new powers and abilities, we also gain new possibilities for going astray and for no longer walking the path of God's plan for us. Father Boholczyk is the Director of Education at the National Catholic Bioethics Center in Philadelphia, and he directs the center's National Catholic Certification Program in Healthcare Ethics. He's a priest of the Diocese of Fall River, Massachusetts. Father Tad, thanks for being with us.
Sai, great to be with you. Thank you.
And how do you assess my assessment that this might be the most perilous, morally perilous area that we have in the world today?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm a little biased. You're asking somebody who works in the area.
Oh, yeah, job security
for you,
huh?
Yeah, so, I mean, I definitely would agree. And, you know, things now that we've got going on, like the cloning of the babies in China, yeah. Sorry, not the cloning, the genetic modification of the babies in China, followed by the modification of the monkeys using human genes, you know, a few weeks back. All of this, it's a reminder to us that we're on the very cusp of manufacturing human beings. And this is really a kind of critical moment, I think, for people to sort of pause, reflect on what's going on around them, and get familiar with some of what is going on in the world of science and bioethics.
What about that? I think people sometimes, Father, and I will count myself among them, you know what? These things get rolling. There's nothing you can do to stop them, and you just have to live with the consequences. It's is that kind of fatalism? I imagine that there's probably some sin at the root of that, but help me through that. Help me. What are we to do about all this?
Yeah, I think you're right. There is a sense of that, partly because of the way that science proceeds with its own mechanisms of funding, which are pretty far removed from public scrutiny. So we've had this controversy where the body parts from abortions were made available to scientists and researchers, and this had been going on a fairly large scale, and many of us were not aware of the extent of it. Even those of us like myself, who were kind of in the field all the time, we knew it was happening, but it wasn't until those videos came out, the kind of special videos that they infiltrated, as it were, and had those interviews with the Planned Parenthood people, that suddenly it came to light. So I think there's that element that some of this is happening under the shroud of a certain darkness, and we don't know all of what's going on. And, you know, even if we were to ask the question now about cloning of human embryos and where is that taking place, I mean, I can certainly name one or two labs that I know of where they're cloning human embryos. But my suspicion would be that this is actually going on in probably many other labs as well. But that kind of information is hard to come by, and it tends to be also driven by the fact that scientists, when they do their work, may withhold what they're doing until they're actually ready to publish a paper. And at that point, then it'll become general public knowledge. So it's just a strange way that science moves forward, and then I think a lot of us get that fatalistic feeling that you're describing, where, gee, I can't do a heck of a lot here, because it's all, you know, outside my purview in the first place, and it's outside of public scrutiny on the second level as well.
And it seems, I mean, the scientist will say, I imagine, well, actually, I recently was speaking to a group that included some scientists and heard somebody say this, that, you know, what scientists do is based on reason, and it's out in the open, and it's full of light and beauty and all that, and service to our fellow man and all that. But so you would think you could say, well, then why are you doing these things in such a hidden way and then revealing them after the fact. But I imagine that the response would be because there's crazy people like you, you Christians who won't let us do science.
Well, yeah, maybe there would be a few who would frame it that way.
Well, maybe I was a little extreme.
Well, I think perhaps also, I mean, when they talk about crazies, they may be thinking, for example, about some animal rights types who, you know, would come in and basically release all the lab animals out of laboratories. I remember hearing a story about a lab that was raided by animal rights people, and there were a whole bunch of crickets that were being used, and they just released all these crickets. And, you know, you just say to yourself, this gets a little bit crazy. So I mean, there are, you know, crazy elements that are out there. I'm not sure that the Christians fall right under that. But in the minds of some, certainly they do. At least they have this impression that Christians are opposed to scientific progress and advancement. They don't want to see science doing certain things. And of course, that's partially true. I mean, Christians are one of the most clear advocates of the need for science that is genuinely ethical. And that's where we run into differences of opinion immediately with others. Others will take more of a fatalistic view and a view that if we can do something, we should go ahead and do it. I mean, if we have the power within our own hands to do this kind of research, then we should venture ahead because there may be a lot of wonderful things that come out at the end, and maybe there's a pot of gold to be made and a number of patents and, you know, a certain amount of fame and glory and other things that all of us as scientists actually are interested in, even though we frame it very often in very, you know, humane terms of just wanting to help humanity. It's actually, I think, a more mixed bag at the end of the day that scientists are driven like non-scientists by motives that are not as pure as they are sometimes presented to be, which is not to say you don't have some scientists who really do have a motivation that is fundamentally oriented towards helping people. I certainly have met some cancer researchers, to give you one example, who, you know, I was convinced that their work was just driven by the highest of motives. Maybe they had had somebody in their family who had suffered a particular type of cancer, and now they were doing everything they could to come up with a, you know, good, powerful cure for that particular type of cancer. So it's a mixed bag. I think that's the story at the end of the day. Like so many of our lives, there is sin, there is virtue, and it mixes together in the crucible of our humanity, as it were.
888-318-7884 is our number, 888-318-7884. Father Tad Poholchik is our guest, and he is scientist and priest, and we're talking about bioethics. If you have questions relating to the bioethics field, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884, whether that's about experimentation, whether it's about medical treatments, whether it's about how life is to be treated at its beginnings, its ends, or when it's under stress in the middle anywhere, you're welcome to call. Well, so Father, having shared with you my somewhat sense of fatalism that scientists are going to do what scientists are going to do, and there's none of us that can stop them, what is even the argument? Well, I suppose I don't know the argument for some things because it just seems so patently obvious that that's wrong. But what is the argument against experimenting with human DNA in the brain of a monkey?
Well, you know, that one is a complicated one because if you're changing just a single gene, which is what those experiments were doing, putting in basically a human homologue or analog of the gene that's already present in the monkey, but then putting in more of the human so that it's sort of what that gene does will, in effect, override the monkey's own gene. You know, I'm not so sure that that raises huge concerns. One gene, you know, some people are saying, well, this is going to make the monkeys a lot smarter and they're going to, you know, we have to watch out what we do here. But typically the understanding now of the way that intelligence is coded and the way that it develops, it's certainly multifactorial. It's not just genes. It's probably a whole panoply of genes, dozens and dozens, including some that are important for the way the brain develops when the baby is growing in utero and later. So those are all going to be critical. And then there's going to be all kinds of other issues as well, environment formation. But I think to sort of simplify it and just say, well, just changing one gene is going to confer some kind of humanness on these monkeys, I don't think anybody in the scientific community or many people outside would actually subscribe to that kind of view. That's not how the science looks. So, you know, I'm not as troubled by doing an experiment like that, where there's a single gene or two that's put into a monkey at an early stage and seeing what some of the effects are. Because monkeys, I mean, these genes, I think, were already 95% homologous. They were 95% the same already between the monkey and the human. So you're adding a little 5% and you're doing a few other, you know, modifications in the level of the expression of these things. And this is not probably a significant worry or threat. What is a worry is what happened in China when they go in and they create human embryos that have been tinkered with genetically. And this was done, you know, and this caused a huge uproar in the scientific community, as well it should have. This is a great concern that we are using our children who are being created in in vitro fertilization clinics. We're using them as research fodder, doing experiments that we're not sure what the outcome is going to be, making some, you know, long vision guesses about what changing this or that gene will do to the human. And this is, you know, completely unacceptable. This is something that should be very, very clear in the minds of all researchers who are in the field of genetics, that we don't want to go in and be tinkering with human embryos. And the church has been abundantly clear on this for decades. You know, now this is not a proper domain for us to be stepping into.
Again, 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. Father Tad Poholchik, our guest. Father Tad is the Director of Education at the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Lines are starting to fill up, so we'll take a quick break, and then we'll take your calls for Father Tad right after this.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I want you to have such confidence in the Lord that you'll find such hope at seeing the beauty of the Lord, the majesty of God. What did our Lord say, huh? If your sins are as scarlet, oh, what? What's going to happen? They shall be made white as snow.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and delighted to have you here with us. Thanks for being with us. I hope you got to celebrate Divine Mercy a little bit in one way or another in your parish or home or wherever you do such things. The Divine Mercy is such a beautiful new, it's I think among the newest solemnities in the Catholic Church, maybe the newest, I don't know. If you don't know about Divine Mercy, you can always just type that into your Google machine and find out all about it, because guess what? Turns out God loves you and wants to pour out his mercy on you. And this is one more way that the Church has of sharing that truth with you. Father Tad Poholchik is our guest this hour. We're talking bioethics, and there are just a ton of people on the phone. So, Father, if it's all right with you, we'll head to the phones.
Sounds great.
All right. Anonymous, watching on YouTube Live, you are up first with Father Tad Poholchik. Your question, Anonymous.
Hello, Father. And I. So I had a question. So I am a researcher in biomedical field, and How do you recommend? What do you recommend? What should we do once we get stuck into this field and it's really hard to get out? Because I spent years and years working in this field, and it's kind of hard to get out, even though we are using, our research is using a lot of things that shouldn't be really used. What you mentioned before. And another question is, since some of us already have a lot of knowledge that came from this that could probably help something in future, how can we use that outside of our just research field?
Yes. Okay. Well, I think the question about what can scientific researchers do in situations where they're concerned about potential ethical compromise, a couple of things. One is, I do think it's actually important for scientists, especially Catholic scientists, to become more familiar with Catholic bioethics. And, maybe I'll make a quick plug for a certification program that I run that is online through the National Catholic Bioethics Center. It's a one-year program. It's all distance learning. And we've had researchers, we've had lawyers, we've had doctors, we've had clergy take this course. And it's a great opportunity over the course of a full year to become familiar with really what the church teaches and to be able to make then some more important distinctions, even in terms of potentially your own work and what sorts of problems would or would not follow from doing certain types of research. Especially when you get into questions of what we call cooperation in evil, these are complicated questions, and it's good to spend a little bit of time learning, about the categories of cooperation. So, for example, in your area, I'm sure you're familiar with HEK293 cells, which are cells that are kidney-derived originally from an abortion that happened many decades ago. And these cell lines are used widely in research. And there are concerns about that. And it's the kind of thing that when researchers come to us and ask us, can I continue to work using these cells? We say, well, if you started a project and you're, halfway into it, already invested, you obviously can't get out of it right now. But your long-term goal should be to move your own laboratory away from the use of those cells and to look for alternatives that were not derived from an abortion. So these kinds of things, just to become familiar with, I think it's very helpful, and that'll give you greater strength, I think, than to be able to avoid unethical research when you have clarity about where those lines actually do fall. And, of course, it differs, too, depending on where you are. I don't know if you have your own lab or whether you're a postdoc researcher or whether you're a graduate student. Depending on where you are in the totem pole, whether you're high up the food chain or whether you're lower down, so to speak, the moral duties that you have are going to be different. When you go in as a student into a lab, you're not going to be able to change very much. But when you are running the lab yourself and you're actually writing grants to the federal government to get money to do your own research, then, of course, you have a lot of say and you have a lot of responsibility for precisely what happens within your own lab. So, those are considerations that I hope are helpful to you as you, reflect on some of these challenges of the ethics today in science.
So thank you, Anonymous, very much for the questions. Father, just say again, if I'm a scientist or doctor, is that who would take this online course that you have at the National Catholic Bioethics Center?
It's actually open to anybody, Si.
Okay.
It's open to anybody who has completed high school and perhaps a little bit of college. And so we actually have pre-med students who once in a while take it. We have high school teachers, but it goes right up across all different professions. So we have had many researchers who have done it, and many MDs, many nurses have taken it. The issue here is that most Catholics are not as well informed as they think they are.
Yes.
On these issues. And so it's a very basic formation, but it goes slowly enough during the entire year. It is a weekly assignment, one assignment a week, and it really gives the students the chance to process the questions very slowly and digest really what the church is teaching is on these very, very important questions.
Could a radio host do it, or do you have to be smart?
Radio host could do it and could do a great job, could do a stellar job on it, believe me.
Maybe some could. Let's go to Debbie right here in California, listening to EWTN Channel 130 on Sirius Satellite Radio. Debbie, your question for Father Tad Boholjik. Hi, Debbie. Are you there with us? Okay. Debbie, we're going
to... Yes, hi. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. Yes, you startled me, Debbie. I was just about to push the button and all right, I'm recovering. Your question for Father.
Okay, Father. I know you're so smart, so thank you so much for picking up my call. I think I saw a National Catholic Register, an advertisement at St. Mary's. You can get a degree in, like, I don't know, 9 months. And it's a master's, I think, in bioethics. And I thought, well, what do you do with... Where do you go when you have a degree with bioethics? Well, I mean, what?
Okay,
where
so
do you go from there?
What does one do with a degree in bioethics, Father?
Yes, Debbie, great question. And the ad that you saw was from the University of Mary in North Dakota. We actually are paired with them. So if you go and do their master's program, the first part of the program will be the certification program that I mentioned earlier during the show tonight. So you'll do the first year with us, and you would do the second year with the University of Mary, and then you'd get the master's degree. Now, in terms of your question of what can you do with this, I think a lot of times people approach this, as they should, from the point of view of what kind of job, you know, will this get me, what kind of market opportunities are out there. And that really, I can't give you some kind of, you know, assurance that it's going to open this or that door. It's going to be part of a formation that will be valuable to you if you decide that you do, in fact, want to move into ethics. And this might mean, for example, that you could work for a Catholic hospital. They have directors of mission. They have other people who are involved with ethics work at various levels in these hospitals. And that might be the sort of thing that, you know, would provide employment. Now, if you're not thinking about employment, it's also extremely useful to have this kind of formation to do something like sitting on an ethics committee of a local hospital near where you live, especially a Catholic hospital. I was on an ethics committee of the only Catholic hospital in our diocese in Fall River, Massachusetts. And I realized, you know, many times as I was sitting there during these meetings, this was 15, 20 years ago, that many of the people sitting around the table had very, very good hearts, but knew next to nothing about what the church actually taught. So if you have a degree like this, you know, you will be somebody who can really provide some substance in that kind of an ethics committee setting. And that's a very valuable, very important contribution to be able to make in this day and age when, you know, I think a lot of times emotion is substituted for more rational judgment when these kinds of bioethical questions come up. So again, you know, there's no fixed answer in terms of what you can do with the degree, but you can go in many other directions. You can go into an arena in which you would do some bioethical writing. We need good people who write well and clearly. You could do things if you're connected with a parish that has strong outreach. You might become somebody who, for example, would provide seminars on how to do end-of-life planning. What about living wills? What about appointing a healthcare proxy? And, you know, if you have some formation and background in these areas, you can be competent to give good presentations and help people even at the parish level. So, you know, I hope that gives you a sense that, you know, there are many possible directions that one can go, and there's not a kind of fixed answer that automatically follows once you have done a degree like that.
Okay, Debbie?
Yes, thank you so much. I'm a nurse, and so that really is helpful. My friend had, her daughter had a stem cell transplant, scleroderma, and she had used her own adult stem cells, and I was very inspired by that. She had it in Chicago, at Chicago Memorial Hospital. And
adult stem cells have, thank you, Debbie, they've been, in general, the most successful kind of stem cell treatments for human beings. Is that right, Father?
That is right. And they have been used a lot for various types of therapies. Mostly, I would say, therapies related to blood disorders, but also to other kinds of conditions as well. I mean, certainly things like leukemia many times will be treated by a stem cell transplant, an adult stem cell transplant, which is really the same thing as a bone marrow transplant.
Debbie, again, thank you very much. Father Tad Poholchek is our guest. We're talking bioethics. And I got to tell you, Father, given the current news, at some point I'm going to have to ask you about vaccines and what our obligations are in that area. I imagine you get a lot of questions about vaccines. More with Father Tad Poholchek on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
In his new audio presentation, The Very First Fathers, apologist Jimmy Akin takes you on a tour of the earliest Christian writings outside the New Testament, from the most famous figures and most notable works to those lesser known but no less important. This pivotal time in the development of the early church is revealed in fascinating detail. Jimmy shows how, even in the first century after the resurrection, it was necessary to defend and explain truths that are still under attack today, such as the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and the perpetual virginity of Mary. The Very First Fathers is a compelling look at the dawn of the Christian age and edifying listening for anyone who wants to understand and defend the full truth of Catholicism. Order your copy of The Very First Fathers today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew she wanted those things, that in them, somehow, she would find God. Over the years, as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What embarrassing event would you like to erase?
Let's talk about it on tomorrow's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
Now let's get back to more of Catholic Answers Live.
Not a big fan of the word anti-vaxxers, I can tell you right now, but I can tell you this as well. If you start talking about vaccines today in our society, you're more likely to get an argument and have somebody end up hating you than I think just about anything else. So I wanted to ask in a reasoned way, to the degree that I'm capable of that, while we have Father Tad, a bioethicist and a scientist himself here with us, about the current outbreaks of measles and things that we're seeing related to parents not vaccinating their children. And I will ask it to you this way, Father, and you can correct me where I make errors or just help me to understand. But it strikes me that we have a strong sense now at this moment of our rights as parents, and there's a good deal of standing up for and vindicating the rights of parents, something I have to say I'm very sympathetic to. But I wonder if we're talking enough or thinking enough about the social obligations of a parent, that we have obligations in raising our children that include other people's children and the larger society as a whole. Is that a fair way to ask the question, and then how do you answer it?
Yeah, you know, I do think that's a fair way to frame it, Cy.
Okay.
I think that this really involves more sometimes than people realize. And I mean, I would even frame it, I would take your lead and go one step further and say, I think you can have parents who will raise issues and say things like, well, I think I have a right in conscience not to be vaccinated for this, that, or the other reason. But I think there's a difference even between a parent deciding for themselves that they won't be vaccinated versus the decision for the child. That I mean, I have run into parents who have said, well, I'm not going to get my child vaccinated, you know, because of my own strong beliefs here. And it's almost as if the child is then, you know, caught in the middle here, when it would be a vaccine that is, you know, very well shown to be helpful, effective, and needed by the population at large in order to maintain herd immunity. And yet this parent will, in a sense, over their child, not make the choice to provide this important form of protection. So then, you know, it extends further, as you're suggesting, in terms of certain types of diseases like the measles that are quite communicable, and the risks that this will apply to other people. This notion of herd immunity is an important one, and it's something that really has a kind of a social conscience to it. And when we realize that if enough of the population is vaccinated, then the likelihood of significant outbreaks goes down. And this has been the goal, really, over the years. And in some epochs, we've said things like, well, it looks like that particular disease is eradicated, which...
Like smallpox, you know, I think.
Right. But I think there's always this question of whether some of these diseases can make a comeback if that herd immunity gets lost. And that's the concern.
Okay. So my concern, I guess, as a parent, say I have an objection to a vaccine, and I can see that there might be in some situations there would be grave moral objections. Say that to produce the vaccine meant hurting another person. You can see that. But with the measles, for example, I was listening to an explanation of it and about herd immunity and all that, and I want to run this by you and just get your response, that there are children in this world who cannot, for medical reasons, be inoculated against the measles. And in some cases, if they get the measles, it will mean death or disability for the child. So as a parent, none of my children have that problem. But don't I have a responsibility to that other child, even if I never meet that child?
Yes, I think that's a great way to put it. There certainly are some children, for example, some who are immunocompromised. Their immune systems just don't work right, and they can't be vaccinated. And this means that the rest of us who have normal immune systems, in a sense, have a duty towards that individual to make sure that we have been vaccinated to protect them. So this definitely, it's a reminder that no man is an island, and that our choices do have ramifications that extend more broadly than just ourselves. And I think vaccines are a remarkable technology that has been developed systematically now over many years, and that we, you know, before we step away from using this incredible tool, we need to be sure we have done due diligence regarding whatever it is that we think constitutes a reason not to vaccinate our children. And, you know, in some cases, like you're mentioning, there will indeed be a valid reason. But, you know, just to give you one other example that comes up all the time, which is this claim about autism, that if I vaccinate my child, then my child will become autistic. You know, this has been thoroughly vetted with studies that involve not thousands, but millions of people, and has been proven that this is not the case. But, it doesn't matter if you do a poll of the general public, you will always get a rather noticeable proportion of people who will still say, oh, vaccines, yeah, they may cause autism, when that has been clearly debunked, you know, and that is an urban myth that is just
right.
So hard to eradicate.
Right, and good scientists with good intentions did the research. But I have to say, there when scientists present themselves in some cases as experts and they fail as experts, or they present themselves in some cases, I'm thinking of a scientist like Richard Dawkins, as the enemies of religion, I do think that religious people in particular might become very suspicious of the institution of science. And it's certainly not that the majority of people who believe this are religious. But do you see what I'm saying? That when an institution such as big science and big pharmacy and all that, when they abuse their positions, they are partly responsible for people not trusting basic science that says, come on, you're not going to get autism from a vaccine.
I agree. And, you know, the whole problem of the fact that money is connected to this always raises concerns. And the original researcher, this Wakefield, who was looking at the autism link, he had been receiving money from lawyers to make his case that vaccines cause autism. And these lawyers were wanting to sue Big Pharma, so they were paying him, apparently, significant sums of money.
Yeah.
And, you know, this kind of thing, of course, this is a disaster. When news of this kind of thing gets out, then people say, well, I don't know who to trust. Should I trust the scientists? Should I trust Big Pharma? And so, you know, we all have a duty here to maintain a kind of integrity, a basic level of integrity with respect to the research that is being done, and to also even the marketing, to make sure that the marketing is not being done in a coercive way.
Right.
And, you know, on and on. I mean, there are many levels on which people's trust can be violated and has been violated in the past.
Yeah.
So we're in a difficult place.
Let's go to phones. Back to phones. Thank you, Father, for engaging with me on that. Mike in Spokane, Washington, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. You are up next. Mike, your question for Father Tad Boholcik.
Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. My question would come in understanding the arguments on the herd and immunity and everything. What happens, for example, with the MMR, where they're using unethical vaccines, where they're utilizing aborted fetal cells? Would we not have a responsibility to not utilize vaccines in that way?
Okay, yeah, Mike, great question. I think this is another area that is widely discussed, and it's an important area for us to be clear about. If certain vaccines were made using cells that came from abortions that happened many decades ago, and that is the case for some of them, as you said, for MMR, that's one example. There are others as well. Then sometimes parents say, well, gee, if there's a distant connection to abortion somewhere, then I can't vaccinate my child. However, when this issue was brought to the Vatican, to the Pontifical Academy for Life, they reviewed this very closely, and they said, well, that's not actually the correct conclusion. They said, if there is not another formulation of the same vaccine that was prepared using not objectionable cells, if there's no such alternative like that, then it is okay to vaccinate your children. But what you should do when you do that is you should write a letter to the pharmaceutical company or take some other step, some concrete action. Let them know and say, hey, this isn't right that we don't have an alternative formulation of this vaccine. Please reformulate the one that you have been selling, and to apply pressure in that way. And I think we tend to be somewhat passive in the face of those actual challenges of, you know, getting on the phone or writing an email or sending a letter to some of these companies. And we will rather say, oh, I'm just not going to vaccinate my child. And then again, our child is being deprived of important protection, sort of out of our sense of moral righteousness, when that sense of moral righteousness should be directed actually at getting a reformulation prepared for these vital vaccines. So I think, you know, I hope that clarifies it, but there's not a prohibition on using these vaccines if they derived from these sources, if there's no other alternative out there. And that's the case for several of them.
Okay, Mike.
There would still be, in my opinion, a problem based on the just from the fact of boycotting the situation. If it's got to be a little bit more, in my opinion, than simply writing a letter, needs to be. I mean, there could be an argument to, in my, you know, could there be an argument, I guess, would be the question of, hey, I'm not going to use this until you guys figure out some other way of going about this. Then I'm not going to use this vaccine, and I have a religious right not to.
Okay, well, a couple of clarifications there, Mike. First, to say I have a religious right not to would not be true. There is not something in Catholic teaching that one could say this provides me with a religious exemption, because there isn't any concrete teaching. In fact, the teaching I just mentioned to you that came from the Pontifical Academy for Life would say the opposite. So, but I think your point is a valuable point, and I think you're correct to say some people will have to do even more than just writing a letter. I mean, the Pontifical Academy for Life mentioned writing a letter as one of, you know, a number of different possibilities. But again, it's going to depend on how you're connected. So, give you another example. You might work yourself in a pharmaceutical company, and you might have more influence over what's going on there. And if that were the case, I would say your moral obligation to do something in the workplace will probably be stronger than, you know, somebody who has absolutely no connection to the pharmaceutical industry and is just interested in vaccinating their child. So there's going to be different gradations, different responsibilities based on where the Lord has placed you, and you need to exercise a good sense of prudence in making sure that you do carry out this duty of witnessing so that in the future, we can change the landscape here and get vaccines that are not formulated in these cell lines that are derived from abortions. That should be the long-term goal here that we should all be moving towards. And, you know, it might be the kind of thing also where simply for some people, they may not even be up to writing a letter, but they may just, it may be the kind of thing where they realize, gee, I've got to share this with my neighbors. And maybe I have a women's group here and I'm going to meet with some of them and I'm going to bring this up. And we're going to talk about, I bet none of the other women in my group even know about this. And, you know, so each of us will have a different duty based on where the Lord has placed us.
Mike, thank you very, very much for that question. As I said, there's probably no bioethics issue that we could cover right now that was generates more emotion. But actually, also in vitro fertilization is one where there's a great deal of emotion around that. If you have questions in that regard, you're welcome. But we've got lots of questions to get to on genetically modified foods and a whole bunch of other things, because bioethics is pretty much where it's at right now as far as difficult, vexing moral questions. So more of that with Father Tad Poholchek right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
I get up in the morning, I turn the radio on, listen to the Mass, listen to the early shows. I transition to my automobile, I flip it over on my iPhone, then start listening to it off the web. And then when I get into the car, I actually listen to it all the way to work. When I get to work, I actually even listen to it online when I'm sitting at my desk. I just love EWTN.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Why do human persons have a right to life? What does the church teach about the morality of in vitro fertilization? How can technologies like cloning, embryonic stem cells, fetal tissue vaccines, and designer genetic screening be wrong if they help people? 20 Answers Bioethics tackles the topics where life, science, and morality meet, offering solid guidance that combines the wisdom of authentic Catholic anthropology with shrewd understanding of the medical and political realities. 20 Answers Bioethics is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting series from Catholic Answers Press.
So many calls, but only one Father Tad. Hey, what about cloning? Have we thought about that? Oh, wait a second. I'm sorry. You cannot clone a Catholic bioethicist. That is like doubly breaking the rules. Cloning itself being wrong, and then sorry, Father. I get a little silly sometimes. Matthew in St. Louis, Missouri. on the Covenant Network. Oh, I'm sorry, Matthew. I apologize. I will get to your call, but I have had a call waiting for a long time that I went to the wrong line. I apologize. Anonymous, are you there with us, Anonymous? And do you have a question?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
I do, and I'm not sure exactly how to word it, so bear with me.
Okay.
Modifying plant, like, you know, genetically modifying corn, wheat, stuff like that. I guess I'm wanting to know is what the church's stance on that is, and if it's acceptable, what is the moral difference between modifying plants and editing and modifying genes of humans, and how do we know, has research been done to look and see how GMOs affect humans when God's design is perfect to begin with?
Wow. And a wonderful, wonderful questions. Thank you. Let's start with what the church teaches about modifying plants that we're going to eat, genetically modified foods.
Yes. All right. Well, I think the key consideration there that the church reminds us about is basically the issue of risk and benefit, that the question of if you're going to make changes in the genes of certain types of foodstuffs, do you have moral certainty that there won't be significant risks associated with that? So there has to be the usual panoply of testing that will be done scientifically to verify that the foods are safe, that they aren't going to be, you know, inducing other problems or disease states in humans who consume them. So from that point of view, you're looking at it from the vantage point of the human who is the consumer of the food, and not so much from the point of view of the question of, you know, can we modify something that God has created? Because, you know, of course we do that all the time. We modify all kinds of things, sometimes genetically, sometimes in other ways. And the issue is not whether we're doing that, but whether we're doing it in a way that is sensible and driven really by a good sense of prudential judgment. So there are going to be many instances where you'll be able to do modifications to a line of crop that will, for example, make it more hardy and able to grow in a climate that it wasn't able to, and this may be able to help people who don't have the right climate normally, but these crops will grow and this will provide them with important nourishment. So that kind of thing, I think we can all see, makes a lot of sense and wouldn't, you know, raise fundamental problems or concerns. Now, this can go in other directions, which might raise some concerns. For example, you could have a company that would engineer certain seeds that would require the seeds would have to be purchased, and then there would be certain insecticides that would be able to be used on these plants to provide a more abundant harvest. And the question then of whether the, so to speak, the strong grip that the company has on making the seeds available, you know, whether this is appropriate and proper. I mean, there are all kinds of questions that could be raised on that level and have been raised, you know, when companies have done this kind of work. But those, again, you know, those are not sort of saying that there's anything intrinsically problematic or worrisome directly about changing the foodstuffs, as long as one is sure that that benefit to burden ratio is appropriate, or benefit to risk ratio is appropriate. So there's not any kind of principled objection to modifying plants to serve mankind. Mankind relies on plant life, of course, very, very directly as part of the food chain.
Okay.
Okay. So have long-term studies been done to see how they affect humans to ensure that they are intrinsically safe?
That's a great question. And I don't know that I could answer that in a broad way. I think for some of the modifications, you're going to have a longer track record, and you're going to have greater assurance that there's no risk. Other ones that are newer, I'm not sure. I think in a lot of cases, the way this will be done is you will feed large amounts of these genetically modified foods to various animals and see whether there are any new diseases that crop up, you know, with a higher frequency, any other obvious anomalies. And, I mean, there's still a question as to whether that's a perfect correlate for what happens in humans. And, of course, animal studies are never a perfect correlate, but they're a good place to start. And so one needs to be sure that there has been at least that level of thorough animal testing before these things move on potentially to use in humans. So, but I can't tell you the current state, you know, for particular genetically modified plants because I don't have that at my fingertips.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those thoughtful questions. That if we there seems to be a general movement against genetically modified foods, and I have to say, it seems to me that it often seems, anyways, Father, that it's kind of it comes from the left wing of the world that it's and. I guess my question there is, the genetically modified foods seem to be feeding a great many people who otherwise would be hungry and increasing the yield of the land. Do we sometimes forget the poor in these calculations? In other words, I just want purity. I want some kind of genetic purity, and this actually is unhelpful to the poor.
In some cases, I think you're quite right. I think that some of the genetically modified foods are going to be a real blessing, also on that level of making sure that there is an abundance of food available for the world's population. But, you know, there may be other cases where I think the question will demand closer scrutiny just to be sure that all those safety issues are attended to, and, you know, also that the economics around it are carefully, that there's, you know, a sense of justice and availability, and that, you know, certain developments are not restricted to the wealthy, et cetera.
Yeah. Okay.
And those are challenging to, of course, get those lined up as they should be.
Did you happen to see, maybe it was 2 weeks ago, New York Times big editorial on the future of child, the future of creating children? Did you happen to see that piece?
That one I did not.
So the idea, I guess, is that what the future that the New York Times sees is that a mother, for example, thinking of having a child, will have something like 10,000 embryos created, and then a genetic survey will be done of all those embryos, and the best, the ones that most meet the mother's criteria, will be the ones selected. I found it horrifying that that would be in a major American newspaper, but do you think that that's a real possibility, a future like that? And what's the argument we can make against it?
I think we are, as I alluded to at the opening of this show, I think we really are right on the cusp of that brave new world where humans are turned into products.
Yes, okay.
And this is a very commercial culture that we're a part of. And I think that what you're describing is not beyond the realm of the possible now. I think that this has become what we call the Wild West of infertility, and that is now giving rise to whatever the consumer requests. Well, if they want it, the customer is always right. And that means there's going to be a lot of this type of quality control over human embryonic production.
A reason for many prayers, Father, and much fasting, I imagine. May we have your blessing before we go, Father?
Yes, I would be happy to. May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much. Our guest has been Father Tad Poholcik. He's the Director of Education at the National Catholic Bioethics Center. You can find them at ncbcenter.org, and you should find them, ncbcenter.org. Tomorrow, 2 hours of open forum. What's more fun than that? We'll see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.